I'm going to just do a little bit of housekeeping, and then Cynthia will be up here, and I'll introduce her. I'm going to do a Zoom, and I'm going to just start calling these until somebody decides this is too cheesy. I'm going to call these still processing, still processing. You see what I did there, everybody? Okay. It leaves me with a lot of latitude to decide what we might do there. One thing we would obviously do is talk about the last gathering, but inevitably 5 million weird things will happen in the world between now and then, right? That's just the timeline we're in, apparently, is that this is going to happen to us consistently. Until we die, I guess. I don't really know. It's been hard, admittedly. Maybe sooner, maybe not. Next gathering, we're doing something very different that I'm really excited about trying. Part of what we want Still Processing to be, right, we want to build some community, we want to do some education, we want to lift up people like Cynthia in the community and other people, people nationwide sometimes, right, with a certain voice nationwide. Those are things we want to do. But another thing that we're trying to do with Still Processing is be good to ourselves, like care for ourselves, learn how to care for ourselves and love ourselves. And even further, maybe, build the kind of life that we want for ourselves as best we can, right? So next month we're going to be doing what's called The Reset with Davin Youngs, who is a gentleman that I met. That's right, the Scots know him. Because him and his family went on a tour with me. And then he started doing what's called The Reset. It is an immersive sound healing experience. I think it'll push us a little bit also, because let's be honest, I don't think Southwest Michigan is the number one destination for this experience, right? I think we're probably pushing the envelope here with this experience in this community, which is great. That's part of what we want to do for this community, is open this community up a little bit more to the world, the country. He's out of Chicago. And in this case, it's entirely experiential. There's no words. He's not going to use words. There's not going to be dogma. This ritual does not have any beliefs attached to it. It is for you to experience it in whatever way you want. So you saw most people are lying down, but if you want to sit, you will sit. We'll get more specifics. Right, so people are going to want to bring mats, maybe bring a pillow, maybe bring eye covering if you want to be completely immersed in the sound. But we'll give instructions on that. We're going to sell tickets. I think we can fit probably 100 people in here. And we think we can get that many people if we try hard enough, and we're going to try hard. So I hope you will consider trying this new experience. Cynthia, come on up, please. So we'll do it similar to how we did the McLaren experience. I'll use Eventbrite. I'll get out the tickets. But we can't have more people come than what we can have capacity for. And we need to make sure there's room for everybody who wants to lay down or whatever way you want to experience that. Cynthia, thanks for being here. Oh, that's right. I got to give you a mic. That seems crucial. My bad.
Thank you so much for having me here. Really grateful for this opportunity and for all of you being here tonight. Oh my goodness, there's a lot of faces that I don't know. There's faces that I do know, so I appreciate the support. But just knowing that there is a community here that is interested in what I have to say, it means a lot, especially people who don't look like me. And what we're going to talk about. Especially people who don't look like me, because growing up in this community, which we'll get more in depth about, absolutely, I didn't always feel like I belonged because of who I look like, my dark hair and my dark skin and my brown eyes. I'm getting a little emotional, actually.
That's fine. Do it.
And to see now the work that I've done full circle, and to see that people care and have an interest, means a lot. I was born and raised in this town. I was born in Holland Hospital. Okay? I went to kindergarten through 12th grade and graduated here from one of the local public schools. And I'm here today to share my story and the work that I'm doing here and will continue to do to make a difference in our community. So thank you.
Yeah, we're grateful. One of the things that it was either first or second still processing, I showed a little video about it was a trans man in Brazil. And I said, it's these folks, the people on the margins, who understand our community in a way that nobody else does, mm-hmm. right? Who know things about us that we can't see in ourselves. And I look at you as somebody like that as well. More grateful to have you.
Thank you.
Let me introduce you, give some info about people. Cynthia Martinez is a Mexican-American born into a working-class family in Holland, Michigan. Cynthia graduated from Western Michigan University's College of Aviation. I'm not sure we're going to be able to get into that, but that was a surprise. Driven by a passion for storytelling, she went on to pursue a master's degree at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, which has been in Columbia has been in the news a lot now. Another thing we can't get to, unfortunately.
It's okay.
Which she completed in 2012. And we will talk about this. In the summer of 2020, Cynthia returned to Michigan. After how long? 20 years gone?
About 20 years of living out of the community, yep.
And produced her first feature documentary, First Voice Generation, which I said we'll get into tonight. Beyond her filmmaking endeavors, Cynthia is a fervent advocate for equity in education. She serves as a trustee of the Board of Education for West Ottawa Public Schools in Holland. She also serves as a board member for, do you guys say that way? Like ALSAME or not?
ALSAME.
ALSAME. That makes more sense.
Yep.
An organization dedicated to Latino student advancement in Michigan education and conducts workshops on scholarship essay writing. She's also a board member for Hope College Trio, Upward Bound, which we will talk about. Actively engages as a keynote speaker, writer, and mentor for numerous Latino students in the Michigan community. Outside of this, an avid marathon runner, folks. And finds joy in her roles as a wife and mother to two children. Cynthia, grateful to have you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to keep this just in case. Okay. I want to get started with a little bit of an update of a story that I sent out on my Substack. So I'm going to play this and talk a little bit about this story and then get into the next clip, which I'm really excited to show you guys, actually. So this happened to a Tufts University student. Her name is Rumesa Oosterk. And this video was taken by a bystander as she was approached by masks. Right? You see her fear. These were ICE agents, but they were not obviously marked as ICE agents. And so even she didn't know what was happening at the beginning. You'll see she's going to get taken away here into an unmarked car. Right? This happened on March 25. And she has been in detention since then. So I'm going to just stop this here and go on to the next video because I do this not to bring you more bad news, but to bring you a little bit of good news. So Rumesa was released on bail. Her story is not over yet. But on May 9th, she was released, and there was a press conference. And I want you to hear what she said at her press conference and talk just a minute about that. She does have an accent, so there are subtitles that'll help you. But as she gets going, you'll understand her. She's a really gentle man.
Thank you, everyone, for all your support and love. In the last 45 days, I lost both my freedom and also my education during a crucial time for my doctoral studies. I am so excited to get back to my studies, community, friends, professors, and my students. My dear professor and love mates are here today, so I just want to highlight that and thank you. Thank to them. So with my incredibly talented lawyers team, Jesse, Massa, and many more, I will continue my case in the court. I came to the United States to pursue my graduate studies, learn and grow as a scholar, and also to contribute to child development fields with my teaching, research, and applied work. America is the greatest democracy in the world, and I believe in those values that we share. I have faith in the American system of justice. This has been very difficult for time for me, for my community, at TAS, at Turkey. But I am so grateful for all the support, kindness, and care. My advisor sent me my dissertation proposal to the president. My lab mates have been reading me books on the phone that are very old. And my department professor students like have sent me so many letters of support, so much love, and comforting words. My union organized on behalf of me and other international students with so much effort, love, and care. I had so many lovely people sending me letters, like comforting words again. So thank you all. And finally, I will also remind you one more time, please don't forget about all these wonderful women in the immigration detention systems. I was so tired of witnessing cries and pain that can be all preventable. Thank you.
So I wanted to show you that because I wanted to show you a win. And I wanted you to see all the different people who were fighting for her and caring for her while she was in detention. I'm finding it easy to see all the terrible things that are happening and harder to see the wins. And lastly, and then I'm pitch it to you, what she says at the end there, right? I mean, she's got her students are helping her read books and they're bringing things. I mean, it's very beautiful. And I just want us to see that this is happening. But I also want to see what she said, say something about what she said at the end, which is, I will also remind you one more time, please don't forget about all these women in the immigration detention systems. And she said, I heard their cries and it's important not to forget those things. There are terrible things happening to people.
You know, I just think about how that impacts. Oh, sorry. Yep.
That's right.
Just locally here, even in our community and in the state of Michigan, right? How do we take a story like this and connect how it brings fear to people right here, locally, right? I was recently with El Seme, right? That is an organization that is a collective of different colleges and universities across the state that pay a membership fee to just kind of know and understand the Latino community in all the different schools across the state. But then we host annually a conference where we help these first-generation students and even undocumented students that are allowed to come to this to understand that a college education is possible for them, right? And so we advocate for that. And what happens at the conference, too, is we donate scholarship funding. So part of the film, which we'll talk about a little bit more, the proceeds from the film, I take a portion of that and give it back to that organization, Trio Upward Bound, some of our local public schools, other organizations here. So with that, we have people from all over the state in that. And right now, we were talking about just the conference was last week about particularly in the Detroit area. Like, this is happening at an alarming rate in the schools. Like, kids are afraid to go to school. Families are afraid to have their children go to school because they're afraid that their kids may be taken away from them, right? So we're seeing issues of the truancy absenteeism happening. And it's even happening here in our local schools where families are afraid to send their kids to school because they're afraid of this type of situation happening or the parents being taken away. So there's a lot of fear going on right now in this community. So we see this is happening. Clearly, she's a Muslim woman, right? We see that. This is on a college campus, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that this is very real, and it's here. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, she was targeted because of an op-ed she did about Israel-Palestine in her student newspaper, and we've seen that in various places as well, and some of those have become more high-profile. And there's been hundreds of them, actually, visas that have been revoked, and then also the type of things you're talking about. It just created an environment of fear, essentially, and terror. for folks. Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of different types of videos like this happening.
Oh, man. That's right.
All across the country right now. So
I'm going to keep bugging
yes.
you.
Oh, sorry.
Get that thing up there so people can
okay.
hear you, girl.
Yep.
All right. All right. I am going to show the intro to Cynthia's film because it opens up a lot of avenues for discussion. And it's beautifully done, and I want to show part of your film. All
Thank
right?
you.
Here we go.
Holland is a small town. It's very bland.
There's not much to do here but go to the beach every once in a while for the sunset.
It's really cold in the winter.
Holland is, it's a calm place in the state of Michigan.
Being Mexican American, I never felt like I belonged. Except when I wore my Dutch costume during tulip time. I left 20 years ago and never looked back until now.
It's definitely changed over the years.
Holland is a place that is trying to be more inclusive and just brushing out all the old ways of being that a lot of people have here.
I mean, to me, Holland is home.
All right, let's get started on this film. All right, so you heard three voices in there, and you're going to see these three students. These are local students in Holland, Michigan. So there's Nayeli, there's Angel, and there's Gael that you follow in the
Correct.
Film. Right?
Yes.
And those are the voices you heard at the beginning giving sort of an overview of how they feel about living in Holland, Michigan. And you heard a variety of things there, right? And you grew up in Holland, Michigan. Then you came back in this film in 2020, and now we're in 2025. So I'd love for you to reflect a little bit about your complex relationship with Holland, Michigan. You did a little bit, but tell us a little more about how it has been, how it is changed maybe in ways, maybe changed again since 2020. I don't even know what's going on anymore.
Right.
So please.
So I am the granddaughter of Mexican migrant farm workers. I am the daughter to two teenage parents who have no more than a high school education. Growing up, I didn't go to summer camp at Camp Geneva. Instead, I stood long hours on a farm picking blueberries. Because my mom told me if I wanted new school clothes for the upcoming school year, I had to go to the fields and pick. Okay? My inspiration behind creating the first Voice Generation film was because of my personal story to break the cycle of generational poverty and be the first in my family to go to college. I had joined the TRIO Upward Bound program at Hope College in high school, and that program changed my life. Or I should
and
say,
and it's been around for a while.
Yes.
60s, I think, that's what I found.
Yes, so TRIO was founded. It's the largest federally funded program in the country. It's not about race with this program. It is about being a low-income first-gen student, and what that means by first-gen is you're the first in your family to go to college, so neither one of your parents have a college education. So as long as you meet those requirements, you can be a part of this program, and it has been at Hope College for over 55 years. So super grateful to Hope College, even though I didn't go there. I like to say I'm sort of a honorary Hope grad because I do so much work there, and I work a lot with the students there at the college, and that program... You know, growing up seeing Hope College as a child, it was this well-manicured Disneyland that I felt that me and my family, we don't go over there. Like, you can see it's perfect and a certain type of person goes there, right? But then getting into the Upward Bound program, and then suddenly I'm eating in Phelps Hall and I'm sleeping in Durfee Hall and I'm taking college classes in Van Zoren. made someone like me feel and know that a college education was possible for somebody like me and that I was welcomed there. And so, yeah, I just, that program, I wanted to bring awareness to in that I wanted more people to know about it and take advantage of it locally and nationally. And so that was one of the reasons I made the film. And secondly, we know that the biggest barrier to getting a college education is funding, finances. And that could be for anyone. We know that, right? But, you know, for me, as somebody who went, like you said, College of Aviation at Western, I had this dream of being a pilot, right? And I eventually got into the College of Aviation at Western all because of that TRIO Upward Bound program, but couldn't finish that the flight program because of finances. And so that sort of haunted me, you know, for my whole life. And that was sort of my other why behind making the film. I didn't want money to be that barrier from someone who wanted the college degree. So that was, those were the two reasons I made the film. I said any profits that I would make from this project, originally it was just supposed to be this 10-minute video that I envisioned bringing awareness to the program, to this feature-length film that went on for 2 years of creating. So it ended up becoming a much bigger endeavor than I planned. But part of it happening was that, you know, when I finished at Western, I left the community. I was like, I'm never going back there, right? Meaning here. And I lived all over the country. And for 12 years, lived in New York City. Thought I was going to try the big city for, you know, a year, and then ended up being there for 12 years. And during that time is when I went to Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And then fast forward to getting the degree, working in news at Univision in Miami, getting married, having my first child, and then a global pandemic happens. Well, you don't want to be in a densely populated area during a global pandemic. And so
when the pandemic hit, you were in Miami working for Univision?
Well, not quite. Like,
close.
We'll just fast forward a little bit. I had left after graduate school. I had gotten the fellowship with Miami in Miami, worked there, but I was dating my now husband who was back in New York. So we were doing the distance thing. And then I wanted to get married. We knew that that was our next step. And then, so I moved back to New York and then had our first child. And then 2019, his job transferred us from New York to Chicago. So March 2019, I had my son, and then we were kind of like 1 foot in, 1 foot out of like, are we really going to move like to the Midwest? And I was like, ooh. So my husband's like, let's try the distance thing for a little bit. And then we ended up buying a condo here in Holland, and then we moved to Chicago in October of 2019. And then, you know, settled into Chicago, and all of a sudden this pandemic happens, right? So, and then everything shut down in Chicago as it did everywhere else. And my husband, who works in the financial industry, his job went completely remote. And we had a one-year-old child, and we lived in a high-rise building in downtown Chicago. And, right, all of these social distancing rules and how many people could be in the elevator. We lived on the 60th floor. You just didn't want to be in Chicago or, again, any place with a lot of people during that time. So my husband's like, why don't we just go stay at the condo in Holland? And I'm like, no. And yeah, that shook me to my core. Like in my soul, New York City was supposed to be for the rest of my life. And yes, I would come back and visit. My whole family is here. But, you know, I would count the days down and like, okay, just got to be there for the weekend. Just going to be there for 4 days. And we're out of here, you know? Obviously, my heart has changed in these last few years through this film, meaning that in creating this film, there's this sense of suddenly I did something in the Holland community and the Holland community loves me back. That's why I said I was so emotional being up here, because it's these moments that make me fall in love with this city and say, yes, I do belong. You know, so the film came out of moving back here and my faith is really important to me. And, you know, that's part of growing up in this community, right? And I said, God, why do you have me back here? And I did a lot of stroller running with my son and soul searching. And suddenly, and reading a lot of news articles about how the education system was being impacted by this global pandemic, And I said, okay, how do I use my education, my passion for storytelling, to make a difference for students like me in this community, right? And bring awareness to this issue that was going on. And I reconnected with the TRIO Upward Bound program, and I told those directors who were still there since I was a kid. And I said, I have this idea. What do you think? And they were all in, and they trusted me. And I started interviewing students in that summer program of 2020 because for them, they also were going through, like, this process of, we've never done this program virtually. We've always done it on Hope College's campus, and they weren't allowed to do that in that summer. And so I was behind the scenes, a fly on the wall with, like, okay, what does that look like? And then really connecting with the students and the families. Originally, we started with, or I should say, about 70% of the film is all me with just a camera and a boom mic. And you know, and following these kids and their families. So what I, again, thought it was just going to be the summer of 2020. Suddenly, I'm like, well, this pandemic isn't over, right? And these kids were so nervous about going into the fall of 2020, their school year. And I'm like, I can't put the camera down. I have to keep going. And at that point, then I sort of narrowed it down to the three who were the most vocal and vulnerable and open to me just following them around and their families being receptive to that as well, right? They were all minors, and we were living in a pandemic too, right? So that was another reason why it was just me filming for the most part. And there was a couple scenes in the film where as time went on, right, like, the kids were in school, right? We all know that. And then they were pulled out of school, and then it was, like, virtual. And so all of these shifts were happening constantly about kids being in and out of school. It gave me different opportunities to film each one in a different way. Yeah. So.
Excellent.
Yep.
Let's do another clip, because this will bring us into a little bit more of a discussion about what Upward Bound did for them and introduce you a little bit more to some of the, I think this one has just Angel and Gael in it.
Why? George, why? No peace!
The Black Lives Matter protests were a huge thing. There was a protest going on like every week. And I never realized how a lot of people in the Holland community have some views that are concerning, because I remember reading an article, this man blamed black people for the treatment they were getting. We were angry about it, and we just kept reading all these hateful things on the internet, and then there were more articles on the Sentinel that were related to that, and we thought, it's not okay to say this stuff. We have to speak up about it.
So again, we're just gonna quick go over the difference between media bias and fake news.
That summer, I was taking a journalism class through Upward Bound, and we were learning how to analyze the news and how to write fact-based articles.
Angel Art, do you have a thought?
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like, I don't know, the top one, I feel like some people would fall for that one.
Yes, and you are so right. Those are two of the ones that people fell for the most and created some pretty crazy conspiracy theories at the time.
Part of the class, my friend Melissa and I wrote an article response to one of the op-eds that was published in the Holland Sentinel, and it was published.
It's right there, so.
And we were quite scared. We didn't know how other people were going to react. You know, we're young Mexican women, and to have our voices out there in a community as conservative as Holland, that's a big thing for us, and we were just so proud of ourselves. A lot of people reposted our articles, and they were like, oh my gosh, these girls are so brilliant. They've got some things to say. You should read it. And when we came back to school, two of our teachers came up to us, and they were like, we've read your article. They were just so wowed by it. And I'm glad that she told us and other students not to be afraid to speak our voices, because it's powerful.
We're going over what we're going to do today, so we are going to start with an icebreaker.
That was my cut.
Just to know you guys, we're going to go into the different forms of communication. So verbal is the word.
We're about to have our Friday session. Juniors and seniors get together once a month with Upward Bound's board.
Verbal is a lot of those options that you.
So before Upward Bound, I was going into my freshman, sophomore year, Those were probably one of the most difficult times during my life. My grades were terrible. My stress was off the charts. And I was introduced to Upward Bound.
Who has a sibling or a friend or a family member that is difficult to talk to, or maybe they're easy to talk to? What makes that easy or difficult? So you can focus on...
So my first semester, my grades weren't improving that much. They were improving, but they weren't going that far. And Andrea talked to me. She's like, if you don't do better, you could have a chance of getting kicked out of the program.
Talking with some of your close people. So this is when people communicate assertively. They state how they feel, but then...
I sat there with her, and I was like, no, I can't get kicked out, because I think that just pushed me into thinking I'm more of a failure. And I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I also want to be successful on my own. I want to prove to my parents what I can do on my own.
So, first of all, I love these. Let me just say that the willingness of these young people to be vulnerable in this way is quite something, right? Like, it's easy to forget that, right? Because you're watching a film, but this is a young man admitting he was struggling and Upward Bound helped him, and an angel, right? You can see how tickled she is that, like, her teachers and other people are complimenting her. And all of this because, in part, right, they have support from family and other people, but Upward Bound is playing a major role here in their lives, like, changing their lives significantly. But, like, you watched it. It's very mundane the way they're helping people. It's a very simple... just people who care being in the lives of these people and pushing them, right? So talk to me a little bit more about Upward Bound, about what these kids were facing, right? You did that a little bit, but...
Yeah. So what you're seeing here in these scenes, right, because at that time the pandemic was happening, they had to do the program virtually in their home. So that's why you see on the screen, they're all meeting in their class. And the teacher, right, she's in her home, the journalism teacher, teaching the class. And that's how the summer of 2020 went for them, where typically they would be staying in the dorms at Hope College and having, like, the college experience. And basically they take the classes that they're going to take in the fall to help prep them for the upcoming school year, right? And so in this scene, too, then they have, like, a senior seminar or... See, the program isn't just about academics. It's about life skills. And so they're learning about communication in this scene, right?
Yeah, that class about, like, learning how to analyze articles and find what things are conspiracy theories.
That's the journalism class. So
everybody
yeah.
in the whole world needs this class, as far as I can tell. So if we can just upscale that to the whole world, that'd be great.
Yes. Sorry. No, it's okay. No, that's a great point, right? Like, and I kind of what's interesting too. I was struggling a little bit with that when you talk about that vulnerability with the students. Originally, we were seven, and originally the students that they had given me on paper were great, but right, you put a camera in front of somebody, and it changes everything. And so, ironically, one of the first scenes filmed was Chelsea Colburn. So if you know Liz Colburn in the community, it's her daughter. So Liz Colburn is a former director of Trio Upward Bound and has been a mentor to me. But her daughters are very involved in the community. So Kelsey was teaching that class. And so I literally had to go to Kelsey's home in Grand Rapids so I could film her teaching the class. Meanwhile, the kids are in Holland, right? So that took work and effort on my part, right? I started this project as a passion project. I had no money. I was just going out there filming. Nobody was paying me to do this, right? It's just because I cared about this program. So you see what's happening, right? Liz is in that shot, so if you know her. But so it's the program isn't just these academic things. You're learning life skills. You're learning resilience. You're learning how to show up at a job interview, how to be professional in that environment. You're learning public speaking and advocacy. I learned advocacy from Upward Bound.
It's amazing.
Right? So I'm sitting in this chair because of Upward Bound. And, you know, I'm bringing attention to that because, right, the next thing you're probably going to talk about, right, is that.
Yeah. So Trio, I don't know how Upward Bound became Trio. I don't know that whole story. But Trio is upper bound is under Trio. Trio
Correct.
Has other things, right?
Yeah, so Trio is basically is the entity or the name of all of the programs. So upper bound is the program that sits in the high schools. So, and then there's Trio SSS, student support services at the college level. So, and then there's like a Trio program that helps veterans and a Trio program that helps like specifically a math and science program within like higher or high schools. Okay. So there's just different segments of Trio. Hopefully I'm explaining this well enough, but, my program was the Trio Upward Bound, which focuses on there's multiple colleges and universities across the country that host this program. It's federally funded. And then, of course, you know, we're using Hope College resources by there's offices in the bottom of Graves Hall. That's where all the offices for Upward Bound are, right? And then they get the fund. They have to write a grant and share how much students are there. And each student costs a certain amount of money. And historically, in the one at Hope College, there's about 90 students who every year have benefited currently, I would say, since I've been on the board that I'm aware of each year. So, yeah, I mean, this program exists. And so when I say high schools or the colleges host these programs, so, like, there's one at Western Michigan University and has been at Wayne State. So there's actually, I want to say, 22 Trio programs in the state of Michigan. There's the student support services at Grand Valley State University. So one of the students in the film who benefited from the one here,
some of the institutions like community colleges and rural regional public universities, small private colleges, if they lose Trio, they would have almost no student success or academic advising available anymore. To say nothing about the entirety of the Upward Bound program. Would not have funding anymore under the new Republican proposed budget, right? So it's not just these students. It's also, as you were saying, there are these universities, small universities, that rely on the federal funding of TRIO to do these various things to help people get through their universities.
Correct.
Right. And veterans. I didn't know that.
Veterans. And then there's the McNair, which is at the doctorate level. They even have supports for even that higher up of education. And so, yeah.
I mean, I hate to read this quote to you, but I feel like I should. This is from some official in the administration said, "Today, the pendulum has swung, and access to college is not the obstacle it was for students of limited means. A renewed focus on academics and scholastic accomplishment by institutions, rather than engaging in woke ideology with federal taxpayer subsidies, would be a welcome change." That's the wording around entirely cutting. We're talking entirely cutting all the federal funding to the programs that helped you and helped three students in this film, as I understand it. We're at the stage of Republicans are going to try and legislate in some way. They haven't done that yet, but maybe they will, and that's what this is a part of. Maybe it can be fought. It's not done yet, right? The cuts are not official yet.
Right.
So, I wanted to let you know about
it. It's proposed. Like, this is something that... Right now, like, I've been in communication with our local representative and senator, and I was just in Lansing last week, and I'm going to continue to do that, you know. So that's part of it right now. So if you're wanting to in any way advocate for TRIO, you can go online and do that. It would mean a lot to you now know about the program, why it's needed right here in our community and the impact that it has for somebody like me to sit in this chair and then, you know, make a film that's continuing to help, you know, full circle. And I want to acknowledge the Upward Bound alum that are in the audience, too, if you are one. I know there's some of you in here. Like, yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Yes.
Thank you.
You know,
good
so,
you.
And I'm yes, you know, and Julian over there. So, and these individuals are making a difference here in our community. There's over 1 million alumni of TRIO across the country. So, anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn. We're going to come back to the film towards the end. I'm going to turn to something that's a little bit more. I found I had this a while, and then I found it today, and I sent it to her because I was like, this is really interesting. Maybe we should talk about this. And she was like, I looked at it. Let's do it. So, this is a clip from a podcast from the Chris Hayes podcast. He's an MSNBC anchor. Some of you will know him. He's interviewing Paulo Ramos, who she's an American journalist, and she has a book, and this is what they're talking about, and this is why it's relevant to our discussion, I think. She has a book called Defectors, The Rise of the Latino Far Right and What It Means for America. And this is part of something that I just thought would be interesting for us to try and tease out a little bit, because from 2020 to 2024, there was a shift in the Latino community towards the Republican Party, towards Trump, which was somewhat unexpected and surprising. And so I just wanted to try and sort that out a little bit. So we're going to listen to this clip, and then Cynthia's going to give us her thoughts.
And over time, essentially, they migrate from being like an other.
My bad. He's talking about the Irish. He's talking about, I don't remember what time period he's talking about, probably 1800s, that there's this movement where certain groups that came over, the Irish, Italians, go from being these outsiders who can't possibly assimilate into American society to being welcomed into whiteness, essentially, becoming white. And that's what he's referencing, and then he'll go on from there.
Mm-hmm. Whose racial identity is like distinct and not white, to being white. And the same happens for Italian Americans, for Greeks, for all kinds of different groups that come over from Europe. Is something like that happening to Latinos? Is that a process that doesn't function in the same way anymore? How do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the, you know, and I've been on the road for the last 2 to 3 weeks, and that question comes up all the time, but as a question mark, because I think what we're all sort of wrestling with is a question of identity. I think there's a big sort of gap between the way that the country sees us collectively as these sort of like brown people of color with immigrant stories, and perhaps a perception that a lot of Latinos have of themselves. And I think in conversation, what you're realizing is that there are some people, including brown people and white Latinos and Afro Latinos, that are kind of starting to see themselves more under this lens of whiteness. And again, it goes back to history, you know? The racial caste system that the Spaniards institutionalized always created a permission structure for all of us Latinos, whether you're Black Latino, Brown Latino, Indigenous, but it created a permission structure for all of us to always draw this direct line to the Spaniards and to the colonizers and to whiteness. And I think in sort of Trump's America, right, where he's really creating this division between the in-group and the out-group, mm-hmm. And in this America where it is true that we are now more Americanized and assimilated and speak English, what you are seeing is that there is a surprisingly growing group of Latinos that do see themselves more reflected in that American whiteness.
So this is fascinating development that I did not sort of see coming, meaning I don't know why the shift. Obviously, she wrote this book and she's trying to explain some of it. But this shift of Latinos from, right, if you go back further, I'll just put this chart up real quick. This gives you what we think. We don't have validated voter information. So these are exit polls, so they're not perfect. Trump won 43% of the overall Latino vote, which is much, much more. And 48%, so almost a plurality of Latino men. And this was a major factor in the election. And she's trying to give some explanation of maybe how the Latino community sees themselves such that they move, presumably, from one camp to another. And I know another big thing I'll just say before I turn it over to you, because you're the one who actually knows about these things, that one of the things we're doing or being forced to do as a community of Americans is differentiate, that there's not just Latinos. There are lots of different Latino communities that are very distinct and different, right? And this is something I think we're just starting to learn. So please, your thoughts.
Yeah, interestingly, this morning I was at the mayor's prayer breakfast in Midtown Center, and I met some Venezuelans. It's very interesting how, you know, a lot of them have come to the community because of the persecution that they are experiencing there. But, you know, we now have a lot of Cubans and Colombians here in the community. And, you know, they struggle with, everybody thinks I'm Mexican, mm-hmm. right? And so I think it's really important to be aware of, yes, we call ourselves Latinos, or Hispanics is another right. term, right? That's even debatable within the Latino community here. People say Hispanic. If I go to New York or LA when I'm showing the film, do not say Hispanic, right? Like, oh, yeah. You would say Latine, Latinx. And so just depending on where I am in the country, I also have to be careful of that too, right? So the labeling. But anyway, we have a lot of different Latinos here that are not just Mexican. So just be aware of that. And I think it's really important and special how people identify. And they're really proud of each and every one of us from different that are historically our ancestors, where they're from is very meaningful and important to us. I think the subject is just so tough. I think about though the opening line of my film with this, right? Like, I never felt like I belonged unless I was wearing my Dutch costume during Tulip Time, right? This whole idea of identity and belonging. She's talking about the whiteness, right? Like, somehow I thought, like, I was never proud of, like, now as a 42-year-old woman, I'm proud of my culture and who I am. And coming out of this area, it took that for me to be proud of who I am.
To leave.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a really sad statement.
It's very sad. But not surprising, I'll be honest. Not surprising.
And so in coming back and in making this film and having these types of conversations, it's my way of reclaiming my identity and who I am. You know, and I think about, you know, this where people are leaning. I have people in my family who voted for Trump. Okay? So this is a very real thing right here in this community. You know, we have this term called machismoism. Machismo, like the man, you know, the leader of the family. Right. And I know.
And that's definitely, it seems like that's a big factor in the move towards Trump.
Yes, because Trump
gives that. Latino men more than women, for sure.
Yes, he gives that, I'm the man, I'm going to protect you. And I know there's people in my family that feel safer with that type of narrative and power. Oh, well, no one's going to mess with us because he's flexing and he's saying I'm the man. And so I feel safe and protected. There is some of that. And then, of course, the state of our economy. That was another reason I've heard from individuals in my family. Well, he's a businessman. He knows what he's talking about. So I trust that. But and these are coming from people who are not college educated too. So keep that in mind, right? That are not doing the right reading and research. They're just taking what they see from a reality TV show and finding that in some way relatable, right?
Do you think there's more now? Do you think that there's more like sort of open conversation or understanding about like we need to think about the decisions we're going to make in relation to this white culture we're living in? Meaning, so you're saying, like, when I grew up here, I didn't feel like I really had a choice. Like, assimilation was the way to survive a way, right? Does it still feel that way? Like, the pull towards assimilation is as strong as it was? I mean, because there's some indication in the film, Angel said, like, it's moving towards inclusivity, right? Like, it's changing, it's starting, right? And now it feels like, to me anyways, even if I just look from 2020 to 2024, I feel like we're in a backlash to the thing. Anyways, how do you see the changes over time in the community?
Yeah, I look at all the different nonprofit groups that we have in our community now that didn't exist before, just programming even in our local schools that didn't exist before. For example, I also feature the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Holland here in the film. That organically happened. I wasn't anticipating that happening, but one of the students was in that program and Boys and Girls Club. And that was, you know, being established here on the south side right when I was kind of finishing high school, I would say. So I never benefited from a Boys and Girls Club, but I feel like I would have greatly benefited from that. Now we have one on the north and south side, so there's two of them. And I think of my nephew who lives on the south side and really has greatly benefited from that program. So in those ways, that type of community-based programming is really, I think, essential and important, especially if I think about if we have funding cuts to like a trio, how do we lean in and continue to support the other nonprofits that are serving our youth community here? So just keep that in mind, that those organizations are helping kids and families when right now, especially with our economy being the way it is, that some kids don't even see that Venezuelan, the people I met today at the prayer breakfast, he was telling me, yeah, some of these kids, like, they're home alone the whole time. Like, one parent's working first shift, and then the other parent's working the second shift, and then one's got to sleep, and who's watching the kids, you know? And, but that is the reality, you know? Yeah. So.
Yeah. I'm going to do, so for people who are new, sometimes I like to do something just silly and fun. This one is silly and fun, and also, like, kind of related to what we're talking about, because it has this component of race in it. And I'm going to take you on, like, this is going to be the tiny journey into the TikTok world, and I need to give you just a little background for this to make any sense. For reasons I don't understand, there was a woman on TikTok, a black woman, who said, people with red hair are actually also black. She said this just like that. She didn't give any explanation for why that was the case or how that was the case or how that made any sense whatsoever. But for reasons that nobody really can understand, it went crazy on TikTok, okay? Meaning other black people chimed in about why they thought this was correct. And then redheaded people, also known as gingers, this will be important in the video, were like, reacting to this new news that maybe they could be welcomed into the black community. It's amazing. It's still happening. It's happening right now. I'm just going to bring you into the conversation with two TikTok clips that I just think are super fun and also super interesting.
The fact that we told the gingers that they can be black and 24 hours later they haven't ruined it yet is exactly why we let y'all be black. Welcome home.
We are taking this so seriously. This is one of the greatest things that has come out of this app. My entire feed is filled with either black creators or with redheaded creators. And it has been well over 24 hours, and I cannot wait to see where this goes. Like so many other redheads, I never felt like I fit in growing up. I was relentlessly bullied and ostracized and fetishized at a very, very young age. So to be made to feel welcome and accepted, it's the first time that's ever happened. So I am not going to take that for granted.
Okay, this is what you need to know. This is him saying, my mood since finding out. So that's just, some people were like really moved to be included, and some people just had the best time with it, as you can see. Anyways, just a quick break there. If you want to say anything, you may. I just think this is super fun because it's like, it's a little bit of the opposite of what I was bringing out with you, which is like, some people try to bring find proximity to whiteness because it brings you a certain cachet. These people are bringing in the blackness, and they're super pumped about it. Anyways, okay.
Yeah.
Back to something like super serious and super weird. And I wanted Cynthia to talk about this because it's very current. And my brain cannot understand this. So let's watch it. This is the PBS NewsHour anchor. Her name is Amna Nawaz. And she's going to tell us about our new white South African refugees.
Today, nearly 60 white South Africans were admitted into the United States. It's part of President Donald Trump's resettlement program for white Afrikaners, largely descendants of Dutch and French colonial settlers in South Africa. Afrikaners also led the racist apartheid government there until it ended in 1994. Today, the White House alleges that a new South African law, which redistributes unused land to the state, is racist, and that the white minority is being persecuted by the black-led government. President Trump even halted all aid to South Africa back in February. Applications from these white families were fast-tracked by the administration, even as it suspended the U.S. refugee resettlement program, leaving thousands of approved refugees worldwide stranded. Joining us now is Bill Frelick, the head of the Refugee and Migrants Rights Division at Human Rights Watch. Bill, welcome to the NewsHour.
Good to be here.
So President Trump was asked about the classification of these families as refugees. Here's what he had to say about conditions in South Africa.
Sorry.
It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about, but it's a terrible thing that's taking place. And farmers are being killed. They happen to be white. But whether they're white or black makes no difference to me. But white farmers are being brutally killed and their land is being confiscated in South Africa.
White farmers being brutally killed, their land being confiscated. What do you make of these allegations of white genocide, as the president has said, as we know Elon Musk has said before, and the classification of these families as refugees?
Yeah. Well, this is not factually supported from any of the information that we've seen. The expropriation law that you mentioned only came into effect in January, and it is stated that it is for non-compensation for private land that would go into public hands. Mm-hmm. If that land has been unused, if there's nobody living and working on that land or developing it. And so far, of course, none of that land has actually been taken. Mm. So there have been homicide rates that are high rates in South Africa. I think it was like 13,000 in 2023, but only single digits were farmers that were killed. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't want anyone to be killed, and I don't want to disparage any one person's story, but we don't have the phenomenon of people fleeing the country as we do with refugees all over the world. There are about 38 million refugees in the world who, by definition, are people who've crossed an international border because they're fleeing persecution, they're fleeing war, they're fleeing conflict. And there are no Afrikaner refugee camps.
I don't have time to also show this video, so I'll just tell you a little bit about it. And then do you want this one? All right, we're playing this one. Let's go. All right. These folks were flown here on a chartered plane, and they were met at the airport by the Deputy Secretary of State. So that's the second highest person in the State Department. And then the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, who you're not going to hear here, but you are going to hear the Deputy Secretary of State is going to speak here, and then you're going to hear Tim Miller from the Bulwark. He's an analyst. React to it a little bit.
My own father was born in Europe and had to leave his country when Hitler came in the 1930s and made his way to South America first and then eventually to the United States. So he is an immigrant who actually, you know, was able to benefit from the many blessings of this country. And one of the reasons that I really wanted to go and work for the government is because I wanted to give back to this country that really brought freedom to my family and allowed us to escape a very difficult situation in another country. So, you know, I know that this is going to be, you know, any adjustment in life, any change takes a while to get used to. But I want you all to know that you are really welcome here and that we respect what you have had to deal with these last few years. We respect the long tradition of your people and what you have accomplished over the years. And I am sure that you will be successful. It's, as you know, a lot of you, I think, are farmers, right? When you have quality seeds, you can put them in foreign soil and they will blossom, they will bloom. And we are excited to welcome you here to our country where we think you will bloom and we will hopefully allow you to have fulfilling lives for your children. And then we will bloom and we will benefit alongside you. So thank you very much for coming here.
Let's go to the video to watch his explanation for why the administration is taking in Afrikaner refugees at the same time they are blocking people fleeing persecution from other countries such as Afghanistan, taking away the protected status from refugees fleeing persecution in places such as Afghanistan. We'll take a look at his answer.
There are many people who fit the criteria of seeking help
who are fleeing persecution. Afghans, for example, I mean, they live in a country run by the Taliban. But they're being denied refugee status. So I'm wondering, why has such an exception been made for the Afrikaners, especially when the South African government says they're not in danger?
I think you may recall that on the president's first day in office, on January 20th of this year, he issued an executive order that paused U.S. refugee programs that had been going at record levels under the prior administration and had brought in people that we were not sure had been carefully vetted for national security issues, and put a pause on the refugee admission program in general. That pause, of course, was subject from the very beginning to exceptions where it was determined that this would be in the interest of the United States. Some of the criteria are making sure that refugees did not pose any challenge to our national security and that they could be assimilated easily into our country.
Making sure they can be assimilated easily into the country. Let's see if we can figure that one out. Why do you think the Afrikaners, you know, the South African Afrikaners, quite a few of those in the administration, Elon Musk, David Sachs, why do we think the Afrikaners could be assimilated into our culture more easily than those fleeing persecution from other countries, say Afghanistan or Africa or Venezuela?
Yeah. React to that. Seeing that, I mean, maybe how did you feel, or what stands out in this madness? It seems like just obvious white supremacy to me. I don't know what else to call it.
I mean, people have been waiting years, right? I think about people
in,
from Afghanistan.
In difficult conditions, in refugee camps.
Yeah, people that have helped our military in Afghanistan that will not be allowed to come here anymore, right? Or paused. And so it's very disheartening. It's appalling to see that. Yeah. And that, again, like the commentator said, that's not to say that what they're experiencing, just that he was saying that single-digit numbers, right? Like, it's not a contest, but, right? It's tough when you know, or what we're experiencing, like, not to think that it's blatant white supremacy, right?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to end on a positive note. Yay. Okay, this is from your film. These are two beautiful moments that you captured. One of them, the one with Angel, seems like it was almost accidental. So you got a phone call? Don't take it away. Never mind. Watch this. These are beautiful moments of two of the people who are in the program that you followed. It's Nayeli and Angel.
How are you feeling?
Couple deep breaths.
Oh, no, that's not my best. All right, now, the moment we have been waiting for. The announcement for Michigan Youth of the Year for 2021.
That's Nayeli.
Our finalists, our State Youth of the Year, will receive a $2,500 scholarship and will represent Michigan in our regional Midwest conference. It is with all the pleasure in the world and my distinct honor that I would like to announce the 2021 Michigan Youth of the Year is, drumroll please, from the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Holland.
Bendiciones, mi amor.
I love you.
Yeah, I'm
That's her right there. That's Cynthia.
Oh my God. They just called me three times. They called me three. Do you think it's about the scholarship? Hello? Yes, this is she. Hi. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. Oh, thank you so much. Oh, this is great. Oh. Right. Oh my goodness. I am so honored. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, can't wait to hear more from you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, bye. Oh my God. Oh my God.
What just happened?
I just got a full ride to Kalamazoo College. I just got the community. Oh my God. I need to call my mom. Oh my God. I got the Prophet Scholarship. Yes, I got the scholarship. Oh,
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
You can breathe now. Can you breathe now? Good. Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
And Gael also went to Hope College, who you saw earlier.
Currently, now at Hope College, just finished his third year at Hope.
Yeah. So tell us about how it went for this. That was Nayeli and Angel, and Gael is the person you saw earlier. Give us some updates.
Yeah, those are two of my favorite scenes. The one with Angel is by far my favorite scene and probably one of the hardest things to capture, right? In production, the biggest thing or challenging is access, right? And throughout this film, getting access into the schools or into public areas in the community was very challenging, and persistence and calling and all of that. With the Community Foundation, right, this was the Promise Scholarship. A student was a recipient. She's a recipient of that scholarship and that program. If you don't know about it, read more about it. The Holland Zealand Community Foundation basically gives and full ride scholarships to students here in our community who are first generation college students. So that's Angel, who you can see someone actually winning it. But it's like a 6-month process almost of interviews and them and interrogating the students, right? But for good reason, to see who is worthy of this scholarship, right? And so Angel was really particular about not letting me film that process, which I was really sad about. But I did know some of the people who were behind choosing who was going to get it. And I knew that she was in the running for it. And so kind of was asking some of those people. And like I said, you don't have to tell me if she's getting it or not. But like, if you know of the moment where you're going to do the phone call, please let me know.
You wanted a tip.
Right. And so thankfully I did get that phone call that it was happening, but literally like within 24 hours of it happening. So it was like maneuvering how knew she was doing the spring play at Holland Public Schools and how was I going to capture that, knowing she's in play practice, knowing that normally any type of filming was always scheduled or prepping her. I made it up that like I was like, hey, I'm in the area. I need to get more footage of blah, blah, blah. Like, are you okay with me? You know, and then basically staking out outside the theater of the school, which you saw, like waiting for her, knowing that the call was going to be at 7, knowing, like, not knowing, right, what was going to happen, okay. Right? So just all of the energy and effort and stress, like, I cannot miss this, yeah. Right? So, but obviously you see that I captured it. So to me, all the time and effort and work and phone calls in that, those seconds, right? There's so much effort that went into that and so many other things. Even Nayeli, I couldn't have made that up. I watched that whole process of her winning.
You started following her long before won anything.
Oh, yeah. And if you come watch the film, you're now probably curious about the film. June 4, 7 p.m., Park Theater. Yeah. We are screening the film. in support of Women of Color Give NextGen. There's a member over here, a student here who's here from Holland High, who's representing that organization. I just want to kind of plug that organization and Women of Color Give, who gave an $8,000 grant to help make this film possible. So anyway, so just plugging that. So you're like, oh, I want to see this film, or I want to know more about these kids' stories leading up to those moments. You can come and watch the film and support a great cause at the same time and continue to have those conversations. They'll probably be, Angel might be at that screening, actually. So the other two, you're probably going to ask, where are they now?
Is Angel graduating?
Angel's graduating June 15. Super proud of her. And she wants to go on to law school. Which, though during the film, she's studying biology and chemistry at Kalamazoo College, but wanted to be a doctor at that time. But I'm not surprised that she wants to go into law now. Where the other two are, Nayeli's studying abroad in Spain, literally just left yesterday, and Gael's studying abroad in Japan. Like, it's incredible what these kids are doing, right? And they're living that dream that I didn't. I wanted to study abroad, but I could barely pay for college, right? And so, anyway, I feel like we kind of lost my train of thought there as far as come see the film. Yes. But just these moments capturing, I couldn't have made, I just, and that's where my faith comes in, right? Like the whole time, I'm like, can I do this? Can I do this? And trying to find funding within the community. And just the little breadcrumbs would show up. The access would come. The funding would come. And God continually showed up and was like, nope, you're supposed to do this. Like, here's the next crumb. And that those scenes, like, they are gold. Like, when I think back of how they came, there's no way I would have known that Nayeli was going to win the Michigan Youth of the Year for the Boys and Girls Club. But somehow she ended up in my film starting from way back in the fall, and I watched this journey unfold of all of them. So, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. We have a little bit of time for questions. Anybody have any questions? Please.
So, Cynthia, hey, girl, hey.
Thank you for being here, man.
Yeah. So, you're on, I think, the Upward Bound board. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So, I remember when I was in undergrad studying social work, and I did a short-term placement at Upward Bound and got to work with Andrea and Liz and all of those amazing folks. And I have actually, well, somewhere, or maybe I've disposed of it, but a picture where we were meeting with Bill Huizenga, because he was the person who was making sure that this funding was supported at the level that it needed to be, and advocating
who Bill is,
for
just,
that.
Just so we're clear,
Bill Huizenga, our local representative here. In fact, there are groups even that go to his office regularly and try to talk to him. But do you have any insider intel, and we're not trying to go too far down that path, but do you have any insider intel on how he's responding, knowing that he was always such an advocate for the program at a local level, because he, you know, would see it? And it did feel, at the time that I met him there, when he was coming to meet with the kids and talk to the leaders of the program, that he believed in it and thought it was a worthy investment.
Honestly, I do not have any information on him. To be honest, I've seen the protesters, if any of you, I salute them, and I think that's incredible, and keep doing that. He's not someone I have interacted with at all. Like I said, I was last week in Lansing, advocated our local rep and, you know, Deborah and Senator Victory and their team. So they're aware of community, but I haven't tried to go to Huizenga's office. Like, you know, that's the next thing. It seems like, again, he doesn't seem very accessible as the other two right now. So I appreciate your support in that matter, right? It takes community, but right to what you just said, right? He's been visible and advocate before. And I'm hopeful, right? Like, it hasn't happened yet, but it's in talking. Like, to my understanding, it's been the most aligned bipartisan vote or support that Trio typically gets from both parties. So I'm hopeful. But we don't know unless we use our voices and advocate for it. So that, you know, that's going to be my next thing. So thank you for raising that, 'cause I haven't been in touch with this off, but, you know, lately I've been seeing a lot about how he's not accessible.
Yeah, let's remind him of his former support. I don't know if this will help, but we should, and we should all do it. It's important. You've seen the impact of these federal dollars, right? Anybody else? Any other questions?
I was just going to give you an update on Huizenga's office.
Hold on. Give us the update.
I'll give you an update from today. I was at retired MEA educators meeting, and Joe Bird, a retired Zealand educator, is pretty passionate about meeting with Huizinga, and she's part of the group that comes every Friday. So tomorrow, 12 to 1, there's going to be a group outside of his office. But his offices are no longer open. Portage, Holland, no one's there. So when Joe was there last, the receptionist says, if you want an appointment, Joe said, if he's not here, I'd like to make an appointment when he is. Well, you have to send an email to his on-site U.S. representative email. And she has never gotten an answer with an appointment. So he's not giving appointments. He's not in his office. He's not communicating. You cannot reach him.
But we could go there tomorrow from 12 to 1. There is a group.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
But the office is closed.
Profiles encouraged. So many profiles encouraged currently.
First of all, thank you. I got to go back in time, but summer of 1981, I had the privilege of being a tutor counselor RA for Upper Bound. So spending 2 months of the summer in dorms and with them, I can tell you that the students had just as much of an influence on the tutor counselors as the tutor counselors had on the students.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you, Megan, too. For
anybody else? Yes.
It was disturbing to see the comment that the funding was going to be eliminated for the TRIO program based on this woke ideology. And that was just really disturbing to me. I'd like to know what the source of that accusation is. Where is this coming from? Can you answer that?
Why they think it's a woke ideological program? Gosh, I mean,
just think that they're not informed. I mean, if you were to go look at a program, have they actually gone to a Hope College or any local? There's plenty, I'm sure, in the D.C. area. You know, I guess it's simply probably are just not. There's not awareness for them to really understand it, that, and they probably just don't have that lived experience of being a first generation college student. I honestly couldn't speak to that, but it is a scary thought to know that they're just making those automatic assumptions.
I think it's just simple scapegoating. I think that using the term woke is a way to scapegoat anything. Mm-hmm. If you can talk about anything is woke, you can scapegoat it. It's bad. We should get rid of it. And scapegoating is bad. Don't do that, please. Anybody else? All right. Cynthia, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
And more information to come about June. June 10th, it's a Tuesday night. This is going to be awesome. I'm excited about this. Hope to see you guys there. And we'll get more info. Thanks.